Imagine Italy. Not the Italy of postcards. There's no sunlit cafes, no slow afternoons with espresso, but a quieter Italy. A strained one. Welcome back to the Church History Podcast, where we tell the story of the church in chronological order. We started 7 years ago with the story of Jesus Christ, and now we're in the time period between the First and Second War. Before we jump into today's episode, I need to apologize for not having an episode in the last 2 weeks. 2 weeks ago, I was at a conference, and last week I had such a terrible cold, and my voice was a disaster. There's still a little bit of it hanging on, so hopefully my voice doesn't sound too bad for you today. Also, a little bit about my family right now. Yesterday, we celebrated my daughter's engagement, and it was great to meet her fiancé's extended family. We do have a wedding coming up, and that is our second one this year. For me personally, I've started working on staff at my church in the children's department, and I am loving that. My biggest passion in life is telling the next generation about Jesus Christ. I live in this small village in Canada, and this church is right here in my little village, so I can walk to work. I have to say, walking through my adorable little village, walking over the bridge with the river that runs through our town, and then walking to my church that I love, and then working there, the whole time I'm literally praying and thanking God for the incredible blessings in my life. And then one more little update, we also just got a new addition to our family, Mocha, our new dog. I posted a reel with some pictures from her on Instagram, so you can check that out. So that's all my life updates. Let's jump into where we left off in our story. What was happening in the church between World War I and World War II? And today, we're looking at the church in Italy. It's 1917. You wake before the sun rises. The house is colder than it should be. Food is scarce again. You count what's left. Some bread, maybe a handful of beans, and already you know it's not going to be enough. Your husband, your brother, your son, they're not here. They're somewhere in the mountains, fighting in a war you barely understand, writing letters that come less and less often. And so, life continues. But everything has changed. Factories now run day and night. Women, wives, mothers, daughters, have stepped into roles they never expected to have. They build weapons, sew uniforms, and keep the country moving while the men are gone. Children are growing up far too quickly. Boys are carrying supplies. Girls help at home. Even the classroom is no longer just a place of learning. It becomes a place of shaping loyalty. Teachers speak of duty, sacrifice, and the glory of Italy. But outside the cities, it's worse. In the border regions, war is not distance. It's close. Too close. Families are forced to leave their homes. Entire villages disappear overnight. Hunger is a constant companion. People survive on roots, leaves, even grass, because they have no choice. It's 1919 now. The war is over. But instead of relief, there's anger. Men come home expecting stability, work, dignity, a future. Instead, all they find is unemployment. Prices have soared. Savings mean nothing. Factories slow down. Jobs disappear. Then strikes erupt across the country. Cities fill with unrest. Workers demand change. Farmers push back. The streets feel unpredictable. Something is about to break. Italy had survived the war, but now it was struggling to survive the peace. And into all of that uncertainty, a promise appears. A promise of order, strength, control. A journalist named Benito Mussolini rises, and he offers something many people feel they desperately need, stability. And for a time, it works, or at least it feels like it does, because life begins to organize itself again. Now, when you wake up in Italy, life feels structured, carefully structured. Your children wear uniforms, not just at school, but also in youth organizations that are teaching them loyalty to the state. Newspapers are all saying the same thing. Voices that disappear grow quieter, or disappear entirely. Work is steady, although very controlled. Leisure is organized. Even rest belongs to the system. There are benefits. Now there's pensions, paid holidays, and support for workers. But all of that comes at a cost. Freedom is no longer something you assume. It's something you begin to notice is gone. Life in Italy before World War II tells a story of contrast. First, there was war, scarcity, fear, loss, then instability, uncertainty, anger, and division, and finally, control, order, but without freedom. For ordinary people, it wasn't just one single experience. It was a constant adjustment. You had to learn how to live, no matter what the world around you became. And as the 1930s move forward, as the crowds grow louder and the government grows stronger, Italy begins to move toward another storm, one even greater than the last. Imagine, it's Sunday morning in Italy. The war may be raging or the politics may be shifting, but one thing is steady. The bell still rings. You walk down the narrow cobblestone streets. Families are gathering, women with scarves over their heads, children dressed in their best, older men leaning on canes. And all the roads lead to the church. In Italy, during World War I and the years that followed, faith wasn't just something you believed, it was something you lived. In Italy, the Roman Catholic Church shaped everything. Birth, marriage, death, the rhythm of the year, even the meaning of suffering. When war took sons from homes, it was the church that offered prayers. When food ran low, it was the parish that offered help. When fear crept in, it was the priest who stood in the pulpit and reminded the people that God had not abandoned them. The city had two powers. You stand in the streets of Rome. On one side, the Italian government. On the other, the church. And in between them, a conflict that was never quite been resolved. Actually, that conflict started in 1870 when Italy seized Rome. The Pope had lived inside the Vatican, but without a country of his own. He was a prisoner, a spiritual leader without any political ground to stand on. This is known as the Roman Question. It was a quiet, unresolved tension, and it had been lingering for decades. Then came the First World War, and during World War I, Italy was pulled into chaos, with loss, hunger, and instability. But the strange thing was, the war didn't solve that Roman question. It didn't settle the tension between the church and the state. Instead, it made everything worse. Because when the war ended, Italy was not at peace. It was fractured. It was economically broken. It was politically unstable and socially divided. And when, out of the chaos, a new government arose, led by Benito Mussolini, Mussolini understood something important. If Italy is going to feel united, he could not ignore the church. And the church understood something too. After decades of tension, it needed protection, it needed security, and it needed to be independent. And so for the first time in generations, both sides were willing to talk. In 1929, the world changed forever. It's 1929, pens touch paper, and history shifts. It's the Lateran Pax, a single agreement. And the impossible finally happens. Vatican City becomes its own independent state. The Pope now has sovereignty, and the long conflict ends. For ordinary Italians, it feels like something sacred has been restored. The church is no longer in conflict with the nation. It stands beside it. but no one fully realizes yet how important this moment will become. Because just a few years later, the world will slide again towards another war, World War II, but this time the Vatican is different. You see, since 1929, the Vatican became a sovereign, neutral state, and that changed everything. When bombs fall across Europe, and while armies move through cities, the Vatican officially becomes neutral, but not untouched, but separate. This neutrality allows it to do something unique, to act as a place of diplomacy, a place of communication, a place where humanitarian efforts can still exist even when the world outside is tearing itself apart. And right in the middle of that war, there's this tiny state trying to remain a place of peace. And when you step back, you begin to see the connection. World War I didn't create Vatican City, but it created the crisis and the instability, the desperation that made it possible, that led to 1929. And in 1929, the treaty that was signed shaped everything that came next. Because without that agreement, the Vatican would not have had the independence it needed to navigate the storm of World War II. What looks like just a political agreement was actually something so much bigger. It was a turning point, a quiet moment that determined how the church would stand in one of the darkest periods and places in human history. And as Europe edged closer to war, the question became clearer. What does it mean for the church to remain neutral in a world ready to be at war? Imagine stepping inside the Vatican in 1930. The world outside is shifting, governments are rising, ideologies are spreading, nations are preparing for war. But here, there is stillness, and at the center of it all, a man watching it happen. His name is Pope Pius XI. He's not leading armies, and he's not commanding governments, but he understands something clear. The great battle of his generation is not political, it's spiritual. It had only been a few years since 1929 when the church had reached its agreement with Mussolini. The Vatican was now independent, and the church had legal protection. And for a moment, it had looked like peace. But Pius XI could see what others were beginning to miss. This new Italy, this fascist Italy, was not content to simply govern. It wanted to shape minds and control beliefs and claim loyalty. And that was where the conflict began. In 1931, Catholic youth groups were being harassed, shut down, and pressured because the state wanted the next generation, and the church refused to give up that generation. Pius XI responded with a document called, in English, "We Do Not Need It." In this document, he did something bold. He called out fascism. Not completely, but clearly, he warned against what he described as the pagan worship of the state. He warned about a government who was trying to take the place of God, a system trying to form souls, not just govern lives. He said it wasn't political, it was theology. But why did this matter so much? Well, here's the thing. Both the church and the state understood the same truth. Whoever shapes the youth will shape the future. The fascist regime builds its youth movements, uniforms, marches, ideology. But the church also has an answer. A movement, not of politics, but of formation. Faith. Identity rooted in Jesus Christ, not the state. And that is why the conflict became unavoidable. By the mid-1930s, Pius XI was no longer just watching Italy. He's watching all of Europe, and what he sees, it's alarming. In Germany, a new ideology is rising, one built on race and power. National identity is elevated above everything else. So, in 1937, he responds again with another declaration. This time, the message is even clearer. It rejects the idea that race, nation, or any leader can replace God, and he writes this in German. It's smuggled into churches, read from pulpits. It's a warning that the regime cannot stop once it begins. That same year, he writes another document, another warning. This time, the target is different: communism. Not nationalism, but materialism. A system that reduces human beings to economics, to class. Pius XI calls out what he believes it is, a threat, not just against the church, but against human dignity itself. So when you step back, you can see what Pius XI is doing. He's not just reacting, he's drawing a line. He drew a line against fascism, against Nazism, and against communism. Three very different systems, but with one common danger. Each one, in its own way, tried to take the place of God. Before World War II, the church in Italy was not simply aligned with power, and it's also not fully opposed. It exists somewhere far more complicated. It was this fragile coexistence. The church negotiated with the state. It speaks with the state. And it resists the state at key moments. Most importantly, it's protecting its space, but also refusing to surrender its message. If you could summarize this moment in Italian history, it would be this. The church gained its freedom in 1929, but that freedom came with a test. Would it stay silent or would it speak? And under Pope Pius XI, it chose to speak. Because as the world moved closer to war, the real question was no longer political. It was spiritual. Who do you belong to? Do you belong to the state? Do you belong to an ideology? Or do you belong to God? In our next episode, we're going to move over to Germany to see how the church responds to the time period in Germany between World War I and World War II. And as the rise of Nazism starts across Germany, you don't want to miss that episode. So, what are the lessons we can learn from Italy during the time period between First and Second World War? Well, first of all, people will trade freedom for stability if they lose hope. In Italy, people were exhausted by war, hunger, and uncertainty. And when Mussolini offered order, they accepted it, even at the cost of freedom. When life feels chaotic, we're tempted to look for security anywhere, even in things that slowly take God's place. If our hope is not grounded in God, then we will settle for false peace. 2. The greatest battle is not political, it's spiritual. Pope Pius XI understood something that others were missing. Fascism, Nazism, and communism weren't just governments or belief systems. They were something competing, trying to shape hearts and minds. Each one tried in its own way to replace God. The real battle is always about who has ultimate authority in your life. Each culture and each era is asking the same question: who do you belong to? And third, the next generation is always the real target. Both the fascist state and the church fought for the youth. The state offered identity through ideology. The church offered identity in Christ. Whoever shapes the next generation shapes the future. Teaching children truth is not optional. It's spiritual warfare. And fourth, the church must not remain silent when truth is at stake. Pius XI didn't remain quiet. He spoke against fascism, the state as God, against Nazism, the race as God, and against communism, with no God at all. And he did that even when it was risky. Silence, in the face of error, always allows deception to grow. The church is called not just to comfort, but to speak truth clearly. And finally, you can have outward peace and still be in spiritual danger. Italy, under fascism, looked stable. Jobs returned, systems worked, life felt organized. But underneath, freedom was gone. Remember, not all peace is from God. True peace is not control. True peace is found in Christ alone. When anything, government, ideology, or culture tries to take the place of God, the church must stand firm, speak truth, and remember who we truly belong to. Thank you for listening today. And I'm going to leave you with this blessing from Numbers. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. May the Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to subscribe on YouTube or your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. We release new content every Monday. And don't forget to check out our website at LoraleeSiemens.com for more information and additional resources. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week as we continue our journey through the incredible history of the church.